Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the final Unbelievable of 2018. I hope you've had a good year and I'm wishing you a very happy new year as 2019 approaches. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the programme that brings different points of view together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter week in and week out here on Unbelievable. Listen to here on Premier Christian Radio and across the world via our podcast. And thanks to all those who have been downloading and feeding back on the podcast over the last year. It's been another record year of downloads for Unbelievable, I'm pleased to say. Over 3.5 million downloads of the show in 2018, which I'm just absolutely thrilled about. We've been able to see ourselves at the top of the UK religion and spirituality charts on occasion on the podcast front, and also exciting to be able to launch a new podcast from the Unbelievable stable as well, the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast, which has also been doing very well in the first few episodes that have been released. So thank you so much, wherever you're listening from, whether via radio, whether via podcast. And don't forget that the Unbelievable website has all of the past shows available to listen back to. You can subscribe there. You can get hold of the newsletter. You can get hold of the Big Conversation as well, that big video debate series that launched this year. And we're looking forward to seeing continue into 2019. If you want to get hold of some of those resources mentioned, the website is premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do join that newsletter. It's a great way to keep up to date with the show, by the way. And the Big Conversation available from thebigconversation.show. If you haven't caught up with the fantastic video debates between some really high profile speakers on the atheist and Christian sides, I highly recommend you do that maybe over the Christmas and New Year break. But right now, let me tell you what's coming up on today's show. Got a great conversation about an unlikely friendship. I thought this was going to be a good way to end the year. So we'll be introducing my guest for that in a moment. Later on in the programme, though, I'm going to be joined by John Dixon of CPX Australia. That's the Centre for Public Christianity in Australia. John is a Bible scholar and a communicator, and he's behind a new documentary called For the Love of God, How the Church is Both Better and Worse Than You Imagine. He's going to be talking to us about that. Don't miss that towards the end of today's programme. We'll also hear some of your feedback as well to the show. Don't forget you can get in touch with the programme via our social media at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the show page, or email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And all those links and more available, as I say, from the show page, where you can find today's programme too, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Let's meet our guests on today's show. You're unbelievable. Well, today we're talking about an unlikely friendship on the show. Kevin Pillau is a Christian evangelist, author, and president of the Louis Pillau Association. Kevin's father, Louis Pillau, has been dubbed the Billy Graham of Latin America, with an evangelistic ministry spanning many decades and many continents. Well, Kevin himself has spearheaded a new kind of mission that involves churches partnering with local authorities, schools and secular services for citywide service. And in his book, Unlikely, Setting Aside Our Differences to Live the Gospel, he tells of what happened when he approached Portland's mayor, Sam Adams, and asked what the churches could do to bless the city. And it was the start of an unlikely friendship between an evangelical Christian leader and a secular gay city leader. So Sam Adams is also joining us on the line today to talk about that experience, what he's learned in the process, and how Christians and people without faith can cooperate for the common good despite their differences in values and beliefs. So Kevin and Sam, welcome along to the program today.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you both with me. I'll start with you, Kevin. We've had the opportunity to meet each other once in person when you were over in the UK recently. You're from Portland, aren't you? Which, by all accounts, is a pretty unique city in the USA. Is that right?
It really is. It's a wonderful place to live, a beautiful part of the country. At the same time, many people tend to think of the U.S. as all being the Bible Belt. Sometimes Europeans tend to think of it that way. But Portland is a much more European-like city when it comes to faith. It's among the least churched parts of the country and a very progressive place politically, and a home of the largest naked bike ride in the world, by the way, as
yes,
well.
Yes, I saw that was a claim to fame. In fact, it was my privilege actually to be out in Portland myself at the end of the summer at a church you're probably aware of, Westside, a Jesus church in Portland. And we were able to host a wonderful, unbelievable conference, USA, under the auspices of that church and its leader, Dominic Doan. And it was really that connection there. And someone he met at that conference who said, hey, I need to connect you with Kevin and the Louis Palau Association. And there we were. We managed to meet up in London. And bless you, you even gave me some Portland coffee roasted beans, which I can tell you have all been consumed now, because the little area where I work in our office were regularly treated to special Portland coffee brews every so often. And so thank you very much. We all appreciated the
yes,
coffee.
Indeed.
Tell us a little bit about the ministry that you're part of, and of course, the role that your father has played in all of this.
Well, Dad has always had a heart to share the good news of Jesus Christ, and he's from Argentina originally, and my mom is a native Oregonian, and that's the reason that Portland, Oregon has been home for many, many decades. And if people are familiar with us, if any listeners are familiar, they would tend to think of my father as kind of a Billy Graham-like figure that would come into a city at the invitation of many, many, some cases hundreds of churches to unite around the proclaiming, the sharing of the message of Jesus Christ. Portland, though, being such an unchurched place, I would say now that God really used the context of Portland, Oregon to help shape us as a ministry. Because, you know, as culture has shifted, as the U.S. has become less and less a Bible Belt kind of a place, a place where fewer and fewer people resonate with the claims of Jesus or the authority of the Bible, those kinds of things, we realized that doing things the same old way was not going to work as well. And frankly, we also recognized that Christians in a place like Portland, particularly if you wanted to use the more specific descriptor of evangelical Christians, had a very bad reputation in Portland. Unfortunately, we'd become known, this was, I think, true across the U.S., but in Portland it was highlighted, become known more for what we were against than what we were for. Because of media portrayals, et cetera, we really had become known primarily for being against things and not really having any positive contribution to make. And so we recognized that for the sake of sharing the good news of Jesus, we really had a reputation problem. And that was what led us to try some new things, to try to rebuild trust by loving and serving the city as well as sharing the good news. So the simple idea was, could we build trust with our city leaders in Portland? Could we help them to see the love that the Christian community had for the city? Could we love and serve unconditionally? And would that actually help us build some new, fresh relationships? And that's indeed what happened.
Well, I mean, we'll obviously explore this in more detail with Sam in a moment, but everything you're saying there rings very true as well here in the UK, I think. You could largely say that the era when Billy Graham came in the 1950s and 60s and was able to simply preach from a stage, the Bible says, and people streamed forward in their thousands, that era is if you like, in the past, because there isn't that natural affinity or understanding that the Bible has some sort of central role in society anymore. And so I think naturally mission has changed in that respect. And of course, we know that Billy Graham passed away earlier this year. And I wonder whether with him, to some extent, at least in many parts of the West, that model of mission is maybe also passing away. What do you think?
In a way it is. I'd say it has to continually be renewed. I'd say the the gifted evangelist, the person who has a passion and a calling and a gifting to communicate the good news of Jesus. I think that role continues. But I would say the focus on simply, as you said, getting a stadium or doing a big event, I would say if that's not coupled with unconditional love and service to the community, deep relationship building with people outside the church, I would say it's much less effective. So we've thrown ourselves into more of a kind of a sustainable movement of the churches. We've recognized that we first have to build trust, and that is often done better through the way that we live out our faith, loving and serving people, in some cases very different from us, who believe differently from us, loving and serving unconditionally without abandoning the desire to share the message. So a simple word and deed approach,
yeah.
Letting the way we live speak first, and then certainly looking for chances to share the message.
Great. Loving the fact that you're with us as well, Sam, to talk this through, because you've obviously known Kevin for several years now. But were you essentially born and raised an Oregonian and in Portland specifically yourself?
Yes, I was. I'm definitely the son of Oregon. I grew up in a small tourist and fishing village called Newport, Oregon, in the Central Oregon coast. My dad was a commercial fisherman. And Portland was the big city, but I grew up in small town Oregon.
And tell us about sort of your growing up. I assume there wasn't a great deal of Christian influence necessarily in that.
We were raised Episcopalian, Irish American Protestants, and you know what Kevin talks about is definitely a journey that I lived in Oregon for decades. Self-described evangelical Christians sponsored and promulgated a number of initiative petition campaigns that were aimed at the gay community. And in Oregon, you can, just by signature, collecting enough signatures, get something on the ballot that the entire state votes for or against. And the Oregon, I won't mention their name because it's in history, but the self-described evangelical Christians, you know, tried or did put, you know, I think like 8 or 9 measures on the ballot that were specifically focused at rolling back or preventing the LGBT community to be, you know, a full community partner as Oregonians. So growing up in a small town as a young gay kid, I definitely experienced for decades the evangelical Christians really were against a lot, and they were against me, just as Kevin sort of alluded to. I knew what they stood against for sure.
And in that sense, you kind of, I guess, through that experience, held into your adult years a fairly dim view of evangelical Christians. Now, obviously, you went in a political direction yourself, and you became, I think, one of the first really openly gay mayors of the town. And so what do you recall of when Kevin first, as it were, got in touch, knocked on your door and talked to you about this possibility of working with churches? What were your initial reactions to that?
Well, I knew Kevin and his father and his family because there had been a number of festivals hosted in Portland. Before I was mayor of the city, I also was chief of staff to a previous mayor, Vera Katz. And so the Plow organization was they were a great partner in terms of the planning and making sure that city services and the festival all worked smoothly together. And part of that was that Lewis would always come in and see the mayor and, you know, and Kevin, his brother, and would come in and talk about plans for the festival. Part of that, they always had the mayor and mayors from around the Portland area come to the festival and welcome and help open and welcome the crowd to the city, to the festival. And Vera Katz, who was the mayor, was, you know, an agnostic Jewish American, but, you know, we all sort of had a really good reaction to the Palaus because they were just so good at outreaching. They were good to work with. So I had that positive background when, as mayor-elect, Kevin came in and his dad and talked about this newest festival, but in addition to it would be that a portion of it would be dedicated to having the participants do some sort of community work. And they asked, you know, they asked me as mayor-elect, you know, what can we help on? And my initial reaction, you know, this was the beginning of the depths of the great economic recession here in the United States. My first reaction was evangelical Christians wanting to help. Does that mean while they're, you know, helping in the schools, there's, you know, some sort of, you know, proselytizing? My second response was, boy, we could really use some help right now. There's so many unmet needs. And the third, you know, response was the Palaus have always been very upfront. They've been very positive in their work. We don't agree on many important issues that are important to both of us, but I always had a positive sort of feeling about them. So I said yes. Took a chance.
You must have realized that at some level it was a political risk in a way, kind of opening the doors in that way to Christians kind of coming alongside, if you like, the secular services in that way.
Yeah, it was. I felt like it was, my staff and advisors felt like it was a significant risk because, you know, the other members of the evangelical community, like the history in Oregon, as I alluded to earlier, was very negative. Yet, the Palau, our experience with the Palau organization and was positive. The needs were so great that I took the chance and said yes, and I'm really glad I did.
Yeah. Do you want to sort of fill in some of the gaps of this story here, Kevin? Because obviously a great deal of this working was dependent on a good working relationship that had obviously been established already with the Lewis Palau Association. And can you just describe some of the things that you went on to plan and work together on with this citywide service project?
Yes, it really was a feeling our way along in the dark at first. We had a clear sense that to rebuild trust between the churches and our city leaders, we simply had to work hard, effectively, humbly. I remember my recollection of the meeting was, you know, initially saying that we're frankly a little bit embarrassed that we have become known more for what we're against rather than what we're for. That certainly isn't what our Christian faith, what our relationship with Jesus should be calling us to be. And so we really had a humble spirit for good reason. And we simply asked Sam and the mayor at the time, Tom Potter, what could we do? And they were very generous, very helpful. Looking back, honestly, I'm astounded and surprised and grateful for my 10-year friendship with Sam now. And the fact that in the face of some political risk and maybe even some pressure behind the scenes, that he stood steadfast and said, we need help. And we're not going to discriminate against a particular part of the community because of the past. Let's work together for the common good. So public schools, for example, Sam came in at a time when Portland public schools were at a fairly low point. The percentage of students that were graduating on time was shockingly low in that season. And so one of the things he said was, what could the churches do to help schools? And in the U.S., there isn't the open door like there is in the U.K. for religious education and things like that. There's a pretty firm line of separation between church and state, so to speak, when it comes to public schools. We made it clear, look, we're not talking about preaching the gospel while we're serving schools. We're talking about simply providing, hopefully, thousands of volunteers to make a difference. And one specific example, there was a school called Roosevelt High School that had been built in the 1920s for 2,000 students that had really seen hard times, and there were only about 400 students left at the time of this conversation, because if you could get your child out of Roosevelt, you'd done it. The neighborhood had changed, It was a very discouraging situation. There was no football team, no American football team that was playing there because they had condemned the grandstands. And so into that environment, though, came some churches and made a remarkable difference on what was originally simply going to be one big day of service. More than 1,000 people came and helped clean up the grounds and do some painting and renovation. But more significantly was the fact that despite this not being the plan, individuals from that particular church just fell in love with the school and the neighborhood and began showing up week after week after week. And about 6 months into this, the principal of the school said to this one staff person of the church, "You're here all the time with various volunteers of the church. Why don't you just office here at the school?" And that has been a multi-year process now. And the believers from this church have been volunteering and making a tremendous difference at Roosevelt High School. And now, in fact, about 70% of the schools in the Portland metro area have at least one church that's raised their hand and said, "That's our school. We are here to love and serve with no strings attached," so to speak. And so I would say that was one great example of churches realizing we've got to come alongside our schools and build a relationship of trust and say, "We're not experts. We're not trying to change you. We're not trying to tell you better ways to do things. You're the educational experts. But could we come alongside in a humble, servant-like posture and make a difference?" And Sam really opened the door for that.
Yeah. Sam, again, I mean, you've already said that there was always this background fear of, is this going to be a cover for proselytization and so on? But you, what was your actual experience of what happened when volunteers from churches rocked up at schools and other local services as well?
Oh, it was astounding and overwhelming. I remember arriving at Roosevelt High School, and you know, I've been in public service a long time, so you know, these sort of school cleanup days are a tradition. And in fact, I've been to previous Roosevelt High School cleanup days, and usually it's, you know, a group of very stalwart parents mowing the yard, you know, mowing the yard around the school, and you know, sweeping and doing what they can with the resources that they have, a small group. But when I arrived for the Palau Organization Festival volunteers, the place was just crawling with people. It seemed like, I think there were hundreds, and they weren't just, they were not only doing the things that they could, the tasks that they could, you know, easily reach, but they had ladders and they were painting parts of the school that hadn't had fresh paint probably since the 1930s. It was so astounding. It was so energizing. I was impressed.
I mean, obviously, you, as you said, you still have your differences of opinion, you know, when it comes to certain beliefs and values and so on. What changed, though, in terms of the way you started to relate during this process with evangelical Christians in Portland, Oregon? Did some of this allay the concerns and history that you evidently felt that there was there?
Well, the whole effort definitely stuck to the no proselytizing assurance, and you know, we had phone numbers if teachers or anyone had concerns. I don't think we ever got a call with concerns, and it really helped me to see that even with evangelical Christians that had been such a big negative part of my life growing up in Oregon, that we actually agreed on so many things. And yes, there are issues that we'll feel passionately about and that we disagree about, but the number of issues that we actually agree on, like good education and healthy people and healthy kids, you know, the amount of agreement was somewhere probably in the back of my mind. I must have thought, well, we must agree on something. But it was so it was wonderful to see how much we actually agreed on, not just in sort of general terms, but in actually what needed to happen to start addressing those issues. And that was helped open my eyes, and in many ways, it definitely changed my view of evangelical Christians, and it definitely changed my view, sort of world view of evangelical Christians. I realized how much, you know, baggage I'd been carrying around, legitimate baggage, but that it was not fair for me to just with a broad brush, you know,
it's that thing where you sometimes when you meet a person face to face, you realize they're not necessarily the caricature or the image you had in your mind, and very often it's only when you take that step of meeting people in person that you suddenly realize, oh, we can be friends, even though I didn't think we could be friends.
Absolutely, sort of experienced, you know, that there's the intellectual sort of, oh, that must be true, to actually experiencing that. You know, there are people that have been a negative part of, or a self-proclaimed group of people that were a negative part of, you know, my life growing up, but that doesn't mean all evangelical Christians are like that. And even amongst those that I disagree with, we actually agree on much more than we disagree on. And we can take action together to not let those disagreements prevent us from taking action together on the issues that we care about.
We're going to go to a quick break, and I'll come back to Kevin for more on that idea of the way friendships flourished through this this activity, but also some of the challenges that do exist when it comes to the mission imperatives, I suppose, of evangelism and the social work that can accompany it at the same time. You're listening to Unbelievable today, talking about an unlikely friendship between Kevin Palau, who is the son of Lewis Palau. And in that sense, he has been heading up the Lewis Palau Association for a number of years now and spearheading these projects that have gone off in all kinds of places around the world now, but really Portland was the test case for much of it. And his friendship with Sam Adams, the former mayor there, and what they did together, despite coming from very different points of view, religiously, socially, politically, and so on. So we're going to continue this conversation in a short moment's time. You're listening to Unbelievable.
Join me, Justin Briley, as the big conversation continues with Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward.
Purposes emerge from the bottom up, from a purposeless process. That's the genius of Darwin's idea.
Well, I think that's a heroic project.
It is.
I don't think it's a possible one.
Michael Roos and John Lennox.
I think the physical resurrection is totally unimportant.
The problem of physical death has actually been solved historically. I want to know about it. To say it's irrelevant, I just don't understand, especially from a philosopher.
Join the conversation on life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We'll be talking about the unlikely friendship between Kevin Palau and Sam Adams on Unbelievable today. Kevin Palau, Christian evangelist, author and president of the Lewis Palau Association, and author of the book Unlikely, Setting Aside Our Differences to Live the Gospel, in which he tells of what happened when he approached Portland's Mayor Sam Adams and asked what the churches could do to bless the city. And Sam has talked already in the programme about the way his own views about evangelical Christians were changed, what he learned along the way as someone from the gay community, which he had often seen Christians and evangelical Christians in particular as the enemy, as it were. And in a way, this book, Kevin, as I read it, is very much about letting the walls down a bit that we often erect, rightly or wrongly, between different people groups, don't we? So I can imagine you learned quite a lot yourself from communities that were different from the ones you normally were around.
Yes, you know, Portland being such a proudly progressive place, you know, we knew that as people trying to follow Jesus in Portland, that we were viewed in a certain way. And unfortunately, as Sam had mentioned, it was for good reason. People calling themselves Christians had been in their eagerness to stand for, you know, quote, the truth as they viewed it. They really became strident and angry and really honestly became viewed as primarily anti this and anti that, and certainly were viewed as homophobic, as just kind of a core part of who we were. And we felt and hoped and prayed that we could find leaders in the LGBTQ community that were willing to build a fresh relationship. And I found in Sam and then other LGBTQ leaders that I had the privilege of meeting through Sam a warmth and a generosity of spirit and a willingness to build relationships despite disagreeing on some pretty core issues. And so, you know, I always feel that it's on us that would be claiming, again, imperfectly, but to be filled with Jesus himself and to be trying to follow him. I think it's on us to be the ones to take that risk and to try to build relationships, to take that first step and say, even though we may fear being misunderstood by either our own camp, so to speak, that we're compromising or that we're watering down what we believe, but I think it's on us to be loving, kind people and working for the common good without abandoning our desire to share the good news of Jesus Christ. So I found in Sam and other leaders that I met through Sam genuine friendship. I can remember conversations where Sam and I, you know, felt, what if we could build trust between other evangelical leaders and other LGBTQ leaders? And it's been a remarkable journey that continues to this day.
What were the issues that you did face of differences ever kind of a barrier in terms of you working together? Did they simply not really come up in the end, or were there any points of disagreement that you had to kind of work through at any point?
You know, I would say that it's so very well known, the points of disagreement with where Sam and I came to was, you know, we thought it's so crystal clear and talked about in the media ad nauseum, the points of disagreement as far as what scripture would teach or what evangelicals would feel scripture teaches about homosexuality, that we thought, why, in a sense, beat a dead horse? Why go over the same ground over and over again? And so I remember a conversation where Sam had brought a number of Portland's LGBTQ leaders into a room, and I had brought some of Portland's leading evangelical pastors. And I'll never forget the way Sam started the meeting, because I thought it was brilliant. Sam, I hope you remember this meeting. I thought it was brilliant.
Yes, I do remember the meeting. I don't know if I was brilliant, but I remember.
Well, what Sam said is, look, this is not a meeting where we, meaning the LGBTQ community, are going to try to persuade the evangelical community to stand with us when it comes to marriage equality, for example. But Kevin and I have found that we agree on so many important things related to making Portland a better place, improving educational outcomes for children, helping children in foster care, working with the refugee community, et cetera. We felt that it would be so important to focus on the areas of agreement, not to pretend that the disagreement isn't there, but to begin on areas of agreement. And then as genuine trust is built, we can then talk about, from a position of genuine friendship and understanding, the important areas of disagreement. So for evangelical Christians, it might relate to explaining the good news of Jesus and what Jesus means to us. And for the LGBTQ community, it may include sharing the pain and hurt caused by evangelicals to the LGBTQ community. So focusing on areas of agreement, we just found so much more important.
Sam, you've already said that there was a danger, in a sense, politically, of sort of choosing to work with evangelical churches in the Portland area. I can imagine that you did get some pushback from folk within the LGBT community when this was all being put together. Do you feel like those fears were ultimately put to rest, and that there is a, I don't know, a better sort of environment now between the LGBT community and evangelical Christians in Portland?
I do think there is a vast improvement among the leadership, especially of the evangelical community and the LGBT community. I think that the opportunity to take action together on issues that we agree upon is, you know, it's very humanizing, and it's very rewarding, and you just can't help but not think of, you know, a LGBT community and a evangelical community, a sort of monolithic community that obviously they're populated by people of all kinds of different personalities and different kind of styles, probably similar outlooks, but those similar outlooks aren't just within each camp. They're also, as we've been talking about, as Kevin alluded to, they're between the two groups. So, you know, acting on areas that there is agreement and respectfully disagreeing on areas where there are, you know, genuine, heartfelt, and in some cases, you know, passionately held beliefs. It did require, I think, all of us to, certainly I felt it, to view, you know, to not just, it's not just a monolithic community, it's a bunch of human beings, you know, trying to make their way. And it was just so surprising. I've said it before, it's worth repeating, just so incredibly surprising how many issues we did agree on. And in hindsight, sort of for how many years maybe both camps had been failing to engage on areas of agreement because we've sort of fell into the trap of, we disagree on some very passionate issues we both care about, so we're not even going to engage.
Mm, yeah. And in a sense, I'm interested to ask you as well, Sam, what you've learned in a sense about Christianity. I suppose engaging with the evangelical community sort of opened your eyes up to a new dimension of Christian faith that perhaps you hadn't encountered necessarily personally before that time.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised Episcopalian and in a small town in Oregon, and where there were evangelical churches, and the breadth and depth of evangelicals' concerns about the community and issues of, you know, the human condition, you know, it was really heartwarming. It was really wonderful to sort of see that and to realize just how much society and, you know, the media dwells on the negative to be successful, and politicians, I'm a recovering politician, you know, can also get involved with that. And I just think that this friendship proves the point that we can make not only a big difference in the world with these unlikely partnerships, but it can be very personally rewarding as well. To be able to, you know, with the trust that comes with interaction and friendship, is the trust to, you know, be able to talk about these areas of disagreement. Again, as Kevin said, not to change minds, but to understand.
Did you want to add anything to that, Kevin?
I just appreciate Sam so much. We've genuinely maintained a friendship despite living on opposite coasts now over the years. And someday we will lure him back to the promised land of Portlandia. But no, seriously, it just shows that friendship is so possible. And for those of us that are joyfully following Jesus in the midst of all the misunderstandings, I think it's the only way that we can hope to be true to our calling as followers of Jesus, to bear witness to the good news, to share the good news in a way that at least might be heard. Because, you know, again, I head up an evangelistic organization, and it's all about genuine relationships, and partly for the purpose of trying to explain the good news. And the good news is so misunderstood and frankly not viewed as good news at all because we mess it up so often. So I think these kinds of friendships point the way to, even in such a divided time, and especially in the political process these days, as Sam said, everything is emphasized as disagreement, difference. These are the enemy, no common ground, no compromise. And I think the average person doesn't feel that way. The average person, I think, longs for a better way. And I think, again, if I'm speaking to those that would be attempting to follow Jesus, that would say, I'm not perfect, but my life is about trying to follow Jesus, take the risk of these kinds of relationships. Be the one that's taking that maybe scary step of saying, I'm going to reach out to someone that probably perceives me as being very bigoted and dogmatic and narrow-minded, and listen to people's experiences. Repent and apologize for the things that need to be apologized for, which is among many other things, the way that the LGBTQ community has been treated by many Jesus followers has been really horrific. And I think we can listen and repent of the way people have been treated without compromising our view of Scripture. And I think that's something that we need to learn.
I was going to ask you, Kevin, in terms of preaching the gospel, which of course, you know, ultimately the Lewis Palau Association is an evangelistic organization. You're unapologetic about that in a sense. I think you quite clearly want to distinguish the works of service from the works of, if you like, proclamation and proselytization. That was obviously important for Sam as well, if you were going to be doing stuff in a sort of official capacity with the city authorities. But where do you do it? Because I can imagine one criticism you guys might get from certain Christians is, well, you know, if you're going to be evangelist, preach the gospel. You know, there's, you know, what are you doing wasting your time going out and doing all of these acts of good service if you're not
yes.
kind of also, you know, telling people about Jesus as you're doing it at the very least? So how do you kind of navigate that balance that you've been trying to strike?
Well, I would say two simple things. One is that in the initiation of this whole effort, we were preparing for one of the big festivals that we do that ultimately drew about 50,000 people over 2 days to Portland's Waterfront Park, this beautiful park right in the heart of downtown Portland. So we weren't hiding the fact that that we were trying to joyfully unleash this kind of army of Jesus followers to love and serve unconditionally and then celebrate our unity within the body of Christ and our loving service to the city with a festival where the good news would be proclaimed, would be shared winsomely by my dad and my brother. So on the one hand, it began with this very clear, we're going to love and serve, and that comes with no strings attached, and we're going to celebrate and share the good news in the public square. And Sam, we invite you to come. And Sam was the one who came. I'll give Sam credit for this as well. We were not thinking about sustaining this effort of serving the community, I'm embarrassed to say. We came from such a tradition of doing the big evangelistic events that Sam was the one who stood on the stage and said, this was an amazingly effective effort to serve the community. Let's keep doing it year after year. So Sam kind of intentionally or not was the one who I would say God used to help us see how important it is to sustain this effort, which has been going for 11 years now. And one other quick story related to, proselytizing or sharing the gospel. Carol Smith, who at the time was the school superintendent of Portland Public Schools, and also, like Sam, a very prominent LGBTQ community member, I remember her expressing concerns about proselytizing. And I remember kind of laughing and saying, you know, Carol, if that's your concern, you don't know our community very well in Portland, because we couldn't pay most of our people to ever open their mouth and talk about Jesus because they are petrified of doing so. And you know, again, there's often this misunderstanding that every evangelical Christian is just determined to share the gospel every single conversation they have, appropriate timing or not. So I would say, you need to find ways to do both well. But I think there are many times when the service needs to simply be service, and we're trusting God to open the doors to share the good news in appropriate relational ways.
Let me come back to you, Sam. Obviously you felt the balance was struck right, and that there was an appropriate division of what was being brought as acts of service for the community and what was, you know, specifically evangelistic outreach that was happening during this particular campaign.
Absolutely. It was discussed by all of us up front and along the way. The need, as Kevin said, for, you know, time and place and what's appropriate. And that's not just, you know, an expectation on evangelical Christians. It's also an expectation for any out non-governmental partner, let's say in the schools. I mean, there are plenty of corporations that make donations to schools like Nike at Roosevelt High School. sort of at the same time that this was going on, also made a donation for a new track and field set up at Roosevelt High School. And, you know, they were not allowed to go in and, you know, and sell things to the children. And I don't mean to make a direct comparison with evangelical Christians and Nikes, but only to draw the point out that these kinds of considerations of what's appropriate when and where are made all the time. So it worked.
Yeah,
it worked really well. And just as an observation, the fact that, I mean, I hope people aren't offended, but it is a widely held stereotype, at least here, especially in the Pacific Northwest, is, you know, that evangelical Christians are interested in proselytizing out in the community, or that's it. And so the fact that these particular projects were not about that, it really not only changed the perception in a very positive way for evangelical Christians on a one-on-one basis, but just the overarching view of evangelical Christians. It may not be a fair stereotyping in terms of always proselytizing like Kevin's saying, but it was one that was widely held.
Obviously, you've worked together brilliantly in terms of being able to do something that despite the ideological and belief differences, has made a huge difference in the Portland area. But when it comes to you specifically, Sam, what do you make of the message, obviously, that Kevin believes in, that Louis Palau has been broadcasting for decades now? Did the conversations ever go in that direction about, you know, the claims of Christianity, you know, and has any of that sort of affected your own personal take on the faith, on Christian faith in particular?
Definitely my view in terms of the notion and the experience that I was brought up with is that the evangelical perspectives on Christianity were, you know, extremely hectoring, divisive, judgmental, sort of an insular community where you weren't involved in the community like other denominations, other faiths. You know, there's a strong tradition in the Pacific Northwest of the United States of the Catholic Community Charities, the Lutheran Community Service organizations, and others. And now there is this very prominent and strong work from the evangelical community. But that's more recently as a result of Kevin and other leaders in the community, and I think it's great. So just that sort of, you know, I think there is success in me personally, success in the community of sort of filling out my perceptions of evangelical Christians in terms of Christianity itself. You know, you see the passion of the many evangelical Christians that I've worked around as part of this friendship and partnership with Kevin, and that's inspiring. I mean, that level of faith and passion is inspiring, and you can tell in many, many cases how genuinely it's held. So it has definitely softened and filled out my views of evangelical Christians and Christianity in general in a really positive way. Mm. I also want to add that the other, I think what this effort has also helped stoke and support is where and how we disagree.
Mm.
You know, there are, you know, ballot measures, government institutions where policies are considered and formulated. And, you know, there has been and will continue to be the issues where Kevin and I disagree on are, you know, meted out, where they're, you know, where they're discussed, community forums and other places. And I do think I think both Kevin and I, and I'd like him to give his view on this. I mean, it has required the leadership that we've brought around us in these discussions. It has required us, A, to take that risk that Kevin talked about, but to also, you know, disagree in a more, you know, understanding and compassionate way, in a less, you know, certainly without personal invectives. It's required us to be our much better adults that we should be.
Which I'm guessing, Kevin, you would say is an essential thing for us all to learn in what is increasingly polarized sort of public conversation going on in terms of politics, religion, society and so on these days.
Yes, I think it requires people to not view it so much as I must win, that I'm so insecure in a way at what I believe that unless I win, I can't rest easy. So for me as a follower of Jesus, it requires that sense. I am so confident in who Jesus is, in my relationship with him. My life has been so changed by the Spirit of Jesus living in me that it's okay if people disagree. I mean, obviously, with my evangelistic heart, you know, you long for everyone to experience the same relationship with Christ that I have. I mean, it's just part of who I am. I've seen it modeled by my dad, and I know many, many believers feel that way, but it can come with that same sense of peace and confidence. And so I think that's a much more winsome and effective way to share the good news anyway, is out of a sense of calm confidence, not red-faced and angry. And if I don't win this argument, oh, maybe the shorings of my faith are weaker than I thought. And I think that's what comes across so often. Wow, are you insecure? You must really not believe what you're saying quite as much as you think, because if you did, I would think you'd come across a little more calmly and a little more reasonably and able to listen, because you're not afraid to listen to other people's arguments. And Justin, I mean, not to puff you up, but I mean, it's one of the reasons I think so many people love your podcast, Love Unbelievable, is because you've modeled that, calmly listening to people you disagree with, being joyful and sharing your faith, unapologetic and unashamed of it, but at the same time, that confidence, I think, brings an ability to build deeper relationships. And these days, it's so important. So I'm grateful for what you do as well.
Well, that's extremely kind of you to say. Thank you, Kevin. We're going to have to wrap things up, gentlemen. And I just want to say thank you so much to both of you for what's been a really tremendous conversation. A bit different to what we normally do. So often we're discussing the sort of arguments and whys and wherefores of Christianity and other worldviews. It was nice to sort of have a conversation on a friendship and on a project in this case that obviously made such a difference in the area. Sam, if people want to follow you, I think they can find you on Twitter at SamAdams_tweets. And you're continuing your work, not anymore as mayor of Portland, but certainly you're still interested in community building and that kind of thing, aren't you?
Absolutely. I came off a stint of 3 years heading up the U.S. program for a global environmental think tank, where I was able to also sort of build on what I learned with Kevin and bring the community of faith into the discussion and the advocacy for, you know, fighting climate change. I really, really enjoy my friendship with Kevin and the friends that, as a result of that, have been brought into my life. So, and the good work that continues. I mean, the best testament is that, you know, the work that was started continues and expands across the United States. So that's just it's so rewarding to see.
Yeah. Well, thank you both again. And if people want to catch up with Kevin, it's at Kevin Palau. And the book is Unlikely, Setting Aside Our Differences to Live the Gospel. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show with me today as well.
Thank you so much, Justin. It's a joy. And as Sam said, to see these kinds of efforts spreading across the country and across the UK, really, people could also check out citygospelmovements.org. is a website that tells a lot of these stories from across the UK and the US and elsewhere of these kinds of unlikely partnerships and cities and church communities working together to improve people's lives and share the good news. citygospelmovements.org is another place people could learn more.
thank you so much. It's been so nice to be able to begin the new year in this way. So thank you very much both for being with me on the program today, Kevin and Sam.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time for our final break. When we're back, we'll be hearing some of your feedback, and I'll be chatting with Australian Bible scholar John Dixon about a new documentary you'll want to watch in 2019, For the Love of God, How the Church is Both Better and Worse Than You Imagined.
Everything that God creates is for the purpose of redeeming human beings.
I'm telling you now, some of your prodigals, husbands, wives, children, brothers, sisters, are not so far from the kingdom as you think.
What has been done on the cross not only reaches into the human heart, but also into nature.
Everything within this world is screaming the name of Jesus, but he's also showing up in a face-to-face way.
Learn how to give reasons for the hope you have. Unbelievable, the Conference 2018, on DVD and digital download. Order now at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of the final show of 2018 here on Unbelievable. What an exciting year it's been of some fantastic shows and conversations. If you're not already familiar with the Unbelievable archive and back catalogue, go and check out some of the topics and titles and guests we've had on over the past year. As I mentioned, a record year for downloads for the show. And I'm so pleased to say that a lot of new people have joined Unbelievable through things like The Big Conversation and many of the high-profile debates we featured on that video debate series. And we'll be hearing some of the feedback we've had to the show over the past year a little later on. We're going to be meeting John Dixon of the Centre for Public Christianity in a moment to tell us about this new documentary film, For the Love of God. But if you can join me next week on Unbelievable for the first show of 2019, a real barnstormer of a debate as we look at the Me Too movement, men, women and the church. We're going to be debating egalitarian versus complementarian theology when it comes to men and women and their roles. Gender justice specialist Natalie Collins will be one of my guests. She's defending an egalitarian view, while Phil Moore, pastor of Everyday Church in London, will be arguing for a complementarian view. Look out for that on your podcast next time on the radio show. And indeed, we'll be releasing a full video via the Unbelievable YouTube channel of that particular debate. Okay, if you want to get in touch with the show, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to email. Looking forward to reading some of your thoughts on recent shows a little later on in this side of the programme. Also, do check us out on social media at unbelievablejb, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. And if you want to comment directly underneath today's show, you can do that via the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Later on Premier, we're going to be meeting Mez McConnell on The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. He's a church leader, director of 20 Schemes. And Mez is very much about getting the church out of the middle class bubble, as it were, and ministering to and being part of working class communities. That's his real passion. He'll be talking to Sam Hales about that on The Profile, available as its own podcast as well, of course, wherever you get your podcasts from. So do make sure to check that out.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's my great pleasure to be joined now by John Dixon. He's a Bible scholar. He's an Anglican minister. He's the founder of the Centre for Public Christianity over in Australia. He's the author of many books, but his most recent project with CPX, that's the short version of the Centre for Public Christianity, is a documentary called For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. John, welcome to Unbelievable.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on. Before we talk about this film, which you've been over recently talking about here in London, and I know it's all around the world now, the Centre for Public Christianity, do you want to just give us 2 minutes on what that is and what it exists for?
It started in 2007, and it was just the dream of a few scholar communicators who thought, wouldn't it be great if there was something that was thoughtful and generous, designed to promote Christianity, to promote the understanding of the Christian faith, not with a particular brand, denomination, but just mere Christianity, one might say. So we got together, got some funding, remarkably, and got offices, got a TV studio, and off we went. And the day one we got into the office, we started writing pieces for the local media in Australia, the mainstream media, and we were astonished that they took what we wrote. They must have seen Centre for Public Christianity and thought, they sound like grown-ups. I've never heard of them, but they sound like grown-ups. And it's just gone on from there, so that now the centre is regularly engaging with the public media.
If people want more on that, it's publicchristianity.org. But what I've really wanted to bring you in for is to talk about this new film, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. It's premiered recently here in the UK. It's been in lots of cinemas in Australia. People can get hold of it via the website. I know that you're putting it out on as many different channels. You've had a version go out on ABC, which is kind of the Australian equivalent of the BBC. So it's a very exciting project. But what is For the Love of God, if you wouldn't mind telling us?
It's a brutally honest, we think, brutally honest account of the best and worst of Christian history. Centre for Public Christianity had devised a documentary on the world religions. We'd written it, we're going to do something on the five major world faiths. And then 3.5 years ago, maybe more now, we just felt like religions aren't going anywhere. We can come back to that. The real question at the moment is, has Christianity only damaged? Has it just raped and pillaged through history and it's bad for us today? So we set about doing that, and it took us 3 years to write and produce, where we offer real honesty about the Crusades, the Inquisitions, the witch trials, but also honesty about the beautiful things that Christianity has given the West, the motifs that secular humanists most love today are entirely Christian gifts.
What do you mean by that?
That annoys my secular atheist friends, but it's so palpably the case.
What kind of motifs are you talking about?
If you went back into Rome or Athens in the middle of the first century and said, is every human being inestimably and equally precious? You could not find someone who thought so. The Greek and Roman paradigm said that maybe the stuff of humans, the physical stuff of humans, is equally low, but the gifts that individual humans have, intellectual, physical, artistic, mean that people aren't equal. And so there was a strong empirical argument about grading human beings. But you might find a few Christians in the year 50 in Rome and in Athens, and Jews, of course, who said, they're all made in the image of God. Absolutely, inestimably, equally precious. And it was the Christian proclamation of that Jewish motif of the image of God that gave the West its view that everyone is equal. Mm. And it's pretty hard to argue out of that based on just the empirical sources.
I had a very similar conversation in this studio with N.T. Wright and Tom Holland, who's a popular historian here in the UK.
Yeah, I know Tom Holland's work.
Yeah, and Tom very much said the same thing, that as a non-Christian, it was actually studying the Roman Empire as a historian that made him realize just how much we owe today to Christianity, which was so radically different in its day and age to what was around it.
The notion of compassion to the poor, that the absolutely poor actually deserve the wealth of the rich. That's how valuable. That was unknown in Greece and Rome. The doctrine of humility, that actually the goal of life is to use all of your powers in service of others. I mean, the very word tapenos in Greek, humility, and humilitas in Latin, meant servitude, crushed, down low. Christians, in almost a macabre upending of values, said, no, they're really good words. I know they mean low, but it's really good. It's really good to be low. Even if you're high, if you lower yourself for the sake of another, that's awesome. And people just thought, what are you talking about? But that caught on. And even our average secular atheist today goes, yeah, if you're a great person, like with all sorts of gifts, if you pour yourself out for others, that's really beautiful.
But they don't realize just what a strange idea that would have been going back 2,000 years before the advent of Christianity.
You need a story that says absolute greatness went to the absolute shame of a Roman cross in order to upend all of that.
So that's how the church is better than you imagined in that sense. But then obviously those same secularists will frequently point out the Crusades, the way they would say the church kind of brought about the Dark Ages by kind of, standing on top of scientific inquiry and that kind of thing. All of that stuff that's a familiar narrative. How does the film try to deal with those kinds of issues?
Again, honestly, the caricature of the story that you just told, almost no one in a medieval department or Middle Ages department in universities today agrees with.
Okay.
In fact, they even avoid using the term Dark Ages because it was far from dark in terms of its literature and philosophy and so on. But Christians did some terrible things. You can see a pivot in the 4th, 5th century when Christians are starting to talk about just war for the first time. And it's quite a breakthrough for Christians. They were mostly entirely pacifists up to that point. But Augustine and others had to do some fancy thinking about, oh, well, there are so many of us now and the emperors want our opinion. Here's how you could have a just war. And so they allowed the possibility of warfare that Christ would approve of. It was still a warfare that only had to be in response to evil or to protect victims, had to be conducted in a way that didn't leave those who lost feeling resentful of the victor and so on. There are all sorts of things, but it opened a door. So that by the 8th and 9th century, as Christians moved throughout Europe, they adopted the kind of warrior culture all around them and justified it theologically. And you eventually get the Crusades at the end of the 11th century. And the dogma was, not only does God approve of this battle, but you can be saved by participating in this battle. That was the new thing.
It'll earn you kind of credit in heaven, basically.
It will.
Yeah.
The way we treat this in the documentary is we interview the top scholars in the world, Thomas Madden in the US and Christopher Tyman at Oxford University, that everyone will say they're the top of the tree on the Crusades, and we just let them speak. So we were very deliberate about the kind of scholars we chose. We had 50 interview subjects, and they are recognizably the world leaders in all of these areas. And we can happily, or maybe not happily, but willingly offer the terrible things Christians did.
You kind of own up to the good and the bad.
Yeah, it was Jesus who said, take the log out of your own eye. Okay, so this part of the film is doing that. But part of what gives us the freedom to do that is anyone can tell that when a Christian is hateful and violent, they're not following their master. They're defying their master. And the basic argument of the film is Jesus wrote a beautiful tune, the love of enemies, self-giving, and so on, that Christians have sometimes performed beautifully with lasting results, and sometimes they've gone right out of key and participated in all that is base and common to humanity, warfare, torture, and so on. Christians didn't invent that. They didn't give that to the Western world. You just go back to Greece and Rome, they were doing fine on the torture and warfare front. The real gifts of Christianity are not their participation in violence. The real gift is the love of love that our culture now assumes. We love love. Love is awesome. Well, that came from somewhere.
Yeah. What kind of reactions are you getting to people who go and see the film?
Mostly from the mainstream media in Australia. Surprise that Christians, a center for public Christianity, has produced something that's pretty honest about the failings of Christianity. And I think this is in a
good
context.
Quality as well. That's
and
not mentioned.
You know,
let's
the production
not forget
values
that.
Are,
exactly.
Production values are great. But I think there's a mood in Australia, particularly following a royal commission into child sexual abuse in the churches, that says Christians cover up their sins. You know, if a priest has been caught molesting someone, they move that priest, they cover it up. In that context, I think people have thought, well, that's really weird that Christians just owning up to the terrible. So actually, we've been delighted at the response from mainstream media. I must say some Christians are disappointed with the production, that maybe we've let Team Jesus down a little bit by being too
candid
about the stories we tell. Because the film doesn't work as we start on all the bad stuff, so that by the last 45 minutes you've forgotten it because it's all great. We go back and forth. And basically say they've sung the tune beautifully and they've sung it terribly. They've sung the tune beautifully and they've sung it terribly.
But I'm so glad that you are telling that story honestly, because I think, especially with what I do with my Unbelievable show and podcast, is people want to hear both sides, mm. and they kind of can tell if they're just getting the version, just the one side, the polished and neatly presented version. And that's not the way life ever works, is it? So it's good to have both sides.
It is remarkable and surprising. And, you know, I've watched your podcast many times, and it's a perfect example of this exact thing.
If people want to get hold of it, wherever they are in the world, even if it's not showing in a cinema near them, how can they do that?
Betterandworse.film. And you can watch the 4 episodes or the 90-minute version. You can purchase it. But the amazing thing is you can watch the entire thing in 5-minute grabs if you want, free of charge. So you can search Crusades or search witch trials and just go to the scenes on that. Great. Free.
Fantastic. Again, that's I've got another one here, fortheloveofgodproject.com, but you've got
betterandworse.film.
Betterandworse.film.
To remember.
That's an easy one. Thank you so much for joining me on the program today, John.
Thank you.
And if you want to find out more about the Center for Public Christianity as well, that's publicchristianity.org, a fantastic organization that John founded out in Australia. It's been so good having you. Thank you very much. All the best as you go back to Oz at some point in the near future. And we look forward to seeing you again soon, hopefully, when you're next over.
Thanks, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Lovely to get some podcast encouragement for Unbelievable. I was checking out some of the recent comments that have been left on the podcast by reviewers. This one says, I'm always stunned by the insightful debates and relevant topics presented through the show. I'm a faithful listener, pun intended, and enjoy the challenge of great minds on a variety of topics. Absolutely recommend for believers and unbelievers alike. Thank you very much. This one from The Nin Fan says, in this post-Christian era, people are beginning to view the genuine need of faith as an extension to an emotional and foolish religion. But this show properly expresses the intelligence and validity of every side and gives Christianity the respect, wit, and truth it requires to endure this. Thank you very much. And this one from another reviewer says, I work in Darfur, Sudan, and it gets lonely without a Christian community. The going gets tough as a Christian. However, Unbelievable has been the scent of water for more than 5 years and has helped me not only to keep my faith, but strengthen it and keep my mind engaged. Thank you, Justin. Thank you very much. This final one says, stimulating, encouraging, respectful and thoughtful. All things our world needs today. Well done, Justin. So appreciate those comments. A couple more that came in as well. This from Gary said, fantastic podcast. As a Christian, this show has helped me understand the views of many other believers and non-believers as they discuss and debate various topics to do with their worldview. Justin has a natural knack of being a fair and gifted mediator. Keep up the good work. And this person says, listen to the debate between Darren Brown and Richard Coles discussing whether Christianity or atheism is the path to happiness. A great example of two people having a respectful conversation and discussing the issues. Thank you so much for those reviews. And the Darren Brown and Richard Coles discussion was, of course, part of our Big Conversation series. Really appreciate all those who have been leaving reviews for the podcast. If you haven't yet and you'd like to, then feel free to leave a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to Unbelievable from as a podcast. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch. The show of a few weeks ago when we debated the statement on social justice, that was Australian activist Jared McKenna and conservative reformed Christian James White debating that statement on social justice. That produced a lot of reaction on Twitter, I can tell you. I was following with interest a lot of the tweeting that was going on around that at the time. But here's a few emails that came in. Cami in Albuquerque, New Mexico says, while going through a period of profound doubt and deconstruction, my pastor turned me onto your show. The first episode I ever listened to was called My Friend, the Atheist Churchgoer. That one hit close to home because my own husband no longer believes there's a God, yet he still attends church with us and he participates in our faith community in an open and honest way. We both enjoy listening to your show now because you continue to demonstrate how to have these difficult and nuanced conversations. Your examples helped us have some conversations that we just weren't able to have before. That's humbling, Cami. Thank you so much for sharing that. And you want to talk about this episode on debating the statement on social justice. That was an exciting one for me, you say, because I've been trying to grapple with these very issues. I've heard some of the theories of intersectionality, white privilege, patriarchy, etc., from many of those on the progressive side of the political spectrum. I'd even started to view the world through some of those lenses. However, through thinkers and intellectuals such as Jordan B. Peterson, I've become more aware of the downfall of those approaches. I hear the conversations around these topics in the secular and political realm, but prior to your episode, I hadn't heard the conversation about how these theories and approaches are affecting the church. As with most complex issues, I think that both sides have something to learn from the other. While I'm not in a place to affirm some of the theological assertions of the statement on social justice, I do think there are some very valid concerns that the statement is trying to address, particularly relating to race relations. I really appreciated the part of the conversation about the table being a place where we should leave behind all identities other than that of being a follower of Christ. I felt like the conversation was about to get into deep and specific details about how the social justice movement has gone too far in the church, but then I was disappointed when James White went after Jared McKenna for saying that Martin Luther King Jr. was crucified. He completely derailed his argument by focusing on a semantical disagreement. Are we not called to take up our cross and follow him? Does that not imply that we're ready and willing to be, metaphorically, crucified for following Christ? In the end, Jared McKenna's real-life experience of living and working with the least of these came across with gentleness and humility, while James White came across as yet another angry reformed crusader. Throughout the episode, I kept thinking that Jonathan Haidt has some great perspectives that could add to this conversation, and then I was pleasantly surprised to hear you say he will be a guest on an upcoming show. Thanks for having guests and topics that dive into these deep and difficult spaces, and for demonstrating how to have the conversations with grace and respect. Cammy in New Mexico, thank you so much. Now, Thomas, I want to write in on that show and says, thanks for another excellent program. Plan to use the debate in a doctoral student discussion group I lead on vocation and social justice. But here's my feedback. James White makes the statement on social justice in the gospel seem so moderate and innocuous, doesn't he? However, holding up the simplicity of the statement's wording is misleading due to the connotations arising from its polemical context and timing. It's impossible to understand the statement's deeper meaning without recognizing what it is reacting against. For example, when Article 4 says, we deny that any obligation that does not arise from God's commandments can be legitimately imposed, the obligations in question include racial reconciliation, implying that Christians are under no obligation to take steps towards healing racial wounds and divides. In Article 14, lectures on social issues and activism aimed at reshaping the wider culture are dismissed as distractions, which is particularly chilling when considering recent outcry in the US over the Paige Patterson rape scandal at Southwestern Seminary. White's co-signer John MacArthur makes no such pretense to moderation. At the 2018 Repairing the Ruins Christian Educators Conference, MacArthur called social justice movements like Me Too and racial reconciliation immoral trends and false gospels. While the statement's wording may leave its opponents ambiguous, MacArthur certainly does not. Words are never spoken in a vacuum, and their meaning is made clear by context, even if the speaker insists the meaning is only the literal words. Thanks again for all the responses that have come in to that episode. Going back a little bit further to the final big conversation episode that we aired at the beginning of November, that was Andy Bannister in conversation with atheist moral philosopher Peter Singer, debating things like human value, rights, do we need God to be good, and that kind of thing. Jim says, awesome job bringing together the big conversation series. Like your regular episodes, they've really helped me understand and articulate my own faith better. And in particular, that debate between Singer and Bannister crystallized one of the issues I have with many humanist approaches to defining ethics. After hearing the recent debate and reading several of the articles posted, I'm left wondering about the general approach taken in developing these ethical and moral frameworks. Maybe I just need to read the humanist approaches more closely, but they generally seem to be based on an assumption that it can be approached as a rational exercise. The problem with this is that modern psychology and cognitive science have pretty clearly shown that humans are not generally rational, logical thinkers. Mind you, that doesn't mean that rational thought plays no role, simply that it's only one of several things that go into our mental processing, especially regarding things like setting values. Doesn't this raise the question of whether we should really expect human ethical frameworks to be based on rational thought, instead of taking into account all that it means to be human? For example, humans are fundamentally social beings. There's a crucial part of who we are. Therefore, it seems a mistake to consider the value of another being only in terms of their characteristics and not include the relationships others may have with them. In other words, when considering something like the value of an anencephalic infant or an adult overcome with dementia, shouldn't their value include others' relationships with them? Terminating my child or withdrawing support from my parent does not affect only them, because of the very deep relationship that exists with them, actually wired into my brain and part of who I am as a human, such actions affect me too. And you're picking up there, obviously, Jim, on two of the examples that Peter Singer brought up in that debate. It may be possible to assert a strictly logical framework and override the love I feel for others, but wouldn't that come at the expense of denying some aspect of my humanity? Seems like this is where the real death of sentience would happen, at least in part, in ourselves, in a part of our own humanity. This strikes against some of the most fundamental aspects of what it means to be healthy, relational beings in addition to rational beings. And you finish up your email here saying, now, individual, overly compassionate actions may shift resources that could have been used to help others, but lack of resources isn't really the fundamental problem today. We've enough resources as a species to take care of everyone. The problem is that resources are distributed non-uniformly. What's really missing is a level of selflessness and love on a global scale to make sure that everyone is taken care of. And from that standpoint, wouldn't we really be better off by limiting our love when we can make some rational argument against it? Or would it be better to err on the side of loving too much? Of sometimes being too compassionate. Seems like the latter is more likely to lead to the greatest good. Whether or not this makes sense from a natural standpoint, it follows from the Christian desire to love others and exhibit God's compassion. I think this is one reason why such ethics are repugnant to Christians. Even beyond the fact that we're created in God's image, we are to love. Loving others needs to be the regular practice, the norm, the default, even when it's hard. True love doesn't ask whether it's really needed, necessary, or warranted. True love just asks. Thank you very much, Jim. You can listen back to the episode Jim is referring there to, the Peter Singer and Andy Bannister big conversation, which was broadcast first show of November, if memory serves, on the podcast, and of course at the bigconversation.show if you want the video. Well, I think that's all we've time for in terms of your feedback today, but always open to more of it. And of course, your ideas for what you'd like to see discussed in terms of guests and topics for 2019. Do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. There's also the ways to get in touch via social media from our website too, where you can listen back to today's show and share it on with others. Why not tell someone else about Unbelievable? Introduce a new listener in 2019. The website is, as ever, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Thanks so much for being with me, and let me tell you what's coming up for our first show in 2019. We're looking at the Me Too movement, men, women, and the church, as gender justice specialist Natalie Collins joins me to defend the egalitarian view. She believes that's the best way that men and women should interact with each other, with complete equality. And she'll be telling us some of her story, which is a quite remarkable story. Phil Moore, pastor of Everyday Church London, will be arguing for the complementarian view, that while men and women are valued equally in the eyes of God, they should have different roles in family and church. So I look forward to bringing you that conversation on the show next week and via our video channel as well. But that's all from me for today, and I hope you have a really great new year. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.